Welcome to The Brain Architects. I'm Amelia Johnson, Communications Lead at the Center on the Developing Child at Harvard University. Today we're sharing a conversation between the Center's Chief Science Officer, Dr. Lindsay Burkhart, and Jennifer Wallace, an award-winning journalist and best-selling author who has written extensively on the topic of mattering. The Center on the Developing Child recently collaborated with Jennifer on a new working paper, Mattering in Early Childhood, Building a Strong Foundation for Life. In this episode of The Brain Architects, you'll learn more about the science we explore in the new paper, including what mattering means, the powerful effects of mattering in early childhood, and strategies for building a sense of mattering in our children. We hope you enjoy this conversation, and remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Now, I'll turn it over to Dr. Burkhart to introduce Jennifer Wallace.
Jennifer Wallace is an award-winning journalist and best-selling author who explores the power of mattering in everyday life. Through research and storytelling, Wallace examines the essential role of mattering in our personal, workplace, and societal health. She's the founder of the Mattering Institute, whose mission is to create cultures of mattering in workplaces and communities, and co-founder of the Mattering Movement, a nonprofit organization dedicated to creating cultures of mattering in our schools. She's also the author of two books focused on the topic of mattering through different lenses, Never Enough, When Achievement Culture Becomes Toxic and What We Can Do About It, and the forthcoming book, Mattering, The Secret to a Life of Deep Connection and Purpose. She's also the co-author of a new paper recently released here at the Center on the Developing Child on the topic of mattering in early childhood and how we can all help ensure children feel they matter from the start. Jennifer, welcome. Thanks so much for being here.
Thrilled to be here.
So recently, you know, this concept of mattering, it's really gained momentum. And I hear about it now in academia, among scientists. I'm hearing a lot more about it from practitioners in the field, education experts. A lot of people who are working in public health, I think, have gotten this idea and really building momentum behind it. And a lot of people also were interested in workforce development and retention. So can you just start off by telling us what mattering is and why do you think it's really important for us all to be thinking about it right now?
So mattering is a fundamental human need. That is to feel valued by ourselves, by our families, by our friends, our colleagues, our communities, and to have a chance to add meaningful value back, again, to ourselves, to our families, to our coworkers, to our wider communities. The reason mattering is so critical right now, so we've needed mattering, you know, ever since we came to this earth, ever since we evolved. But mattering is going dangerously unmet today for too many people. We often talk about the symptoms of not mattering, things like loneliness, anxiety, burnout, political polarization. These are symptoms, but talking about mattering in these terms, it doesn't help us get to the root cause, the root of why we are feeling so lonely and disconnected and disengaged is that we have been treating this fundamental human need as a nice to have and not as the fundamental need that it really is. So when we feel like we matter, we show up fully. We want to connect. We want to contribute. We want to engage with the world around us. But when we don't feel like we matter, we often withdraw. We can become anxious, depressed. Some of us might turn to substances or even self-harm to try to alleviate that pain of not feeling valued. Others might lash out in anger. We're seeing this today in the public square. People going to political extremes to be heard, to say, "Listen to me, my voice matters here." This need in the age of AI, which we are entering so rapidly right now, this need to matter is not going to go away. If anything, it's going to accelerate when technology replaces things that humans naturally did to feel valued, right, in their communities. Now that AI is going to replace it, this need is only going to get stronger.
Yeah, I think that's so well said, because it does feel like there's something about this moment where when I read about mattering and I read your books, it just feels more important than ever. And you said that so well, because I think it's something maybe that we took for granted. But now that when you start to pay attention to it, it sort of feels very obvious.
I mean, we used to, right, when we lived in villages, in really rooted and deeply connected villages, people would ask a neighbor for a ride to the airport, or instead of calling an Uber, or if you were driving and passed an elderly neighbor's home and noticed that the gutter was falling down, you might on a Saturday morning, you know, climb up on your ladder and fix it for her. But now we assume that someone will call TaskRabbit. So we have outsourced so many of the ways in our daily lives that we used to feel like we mattered. And we have outsourced it to technology, but that need is still there.
Yeah. When I first learned about mattering from you, you know, it was coming from my lens as a parent. You know, you and I talked about, I have two adolescents in my house, soon to be three. And I was reading about, you know, wanting to understand adolescent development. And we all want to know how we can kind of show up as our best selves. And so when I read your first book, it really resonated with me as a parent, as a caregiver. And I think people in middle schools and high schools are sort of increasingly talking about mattering and understanding it. But what I'm finding now that I'm sort of like a, I don't know, I want to be a mattering ambassador, is that I feel like when I go into my conversations that are more about what young children need to thrive, I don't hear mattering brought into those spaces as much now. And so you and I had talked about how this is, I think, a real opportunity. And I was very fortunate to recently work on this new paper with you, where we dive into the foundations of mattering in early childhood. So I would love if you could share with people listening in, you know, a little bit about when you think our sense of mattering begins and why you think it's really important, especially in the moment that we just talked about, to really build this ecosystem of mattering for very young children.
So I'm so glad you asked that. So the researchers who study mattering say that after the human motivation, the human drive for food and shelter, it is the instinct, the need, the drive to matter that drives human behavior for better or for worse. This means that the need to matter shows up from the very first days. From the very first days, it's the cry, it's the, do I matter to you? Am I valued here? Am I safe? I would say in my mind, you know, when we think about Maslow's hierarchy, that after food and shelter, it is this need to matter. That is what gives us the foundation for the necessary sense of security that a young child needs to be able to grow and thrive. So what does that look like in practical terms? It's a child making eye contact with a caregiver or a parent. It is a cry expressing a need, and that cry being met, and being in the meeting of that cry, a young baby, an infant, feeling like my needs matter here. I am safe here. I am valued. And as a child grows up, even as early as one or two, they are starting to look at their world and saying, you know, where do I fit in? Can I, you know, they're not explicitly, obviously, thinking about right. it in terms of mattering, but a grandparent sitting on a couch asking a two-year-old, can you go grab my reading glasses for me? Can you do these little things? Can you throw out that trash that's on the floor? Can you help us in engaging young people in ways that prove to them, not only do they feel valued, young people need, babies, infants, they need that social proof that they are valued. And where they get that social proof, again, is in the eye contact, is in the response, is in feeling, as they get older, feeling relied on and depended on. I mean, we know in the field that the introduction to society for a child is the family unit, is the unit that they are growing up in. So to teach our young people, our babies, how to be toddlers, how to be functioning members of the family, is how we teach them how to be functioning members of society. It's how we teach them that they are valued and that they are relied on to add value in meaningful ways. So just to sum it up even more, it is from our earliest days, It is the need to make eye contact to get that social proof that we are valued here, that we are worthy of attention, we are worthy of our needs getting met. And as children develop and can start seeing that they have a role in the family, giving them chores, giving them small things where they can add value and appreciating them out loud, right? Instead of just saying, thank you for the glasses, you might, to reinforce the sense of mattering, you might say, thank you for always being so reliable. I know I can count on you when I need you. You are such an important part of our family. So teaching kids that not only are they valued, but that they are able to add value back to other people in their lives.
I love that. And I think, you know, from a child development perspective, it reminds me of like first the emotional security, right? Even that starting with that, when you return a child's smile or you return their babble or you help them to learn these early foundational skills for how we interpret and respond to other people's emotions, that really sets the stable foundation that supports mental health in childhood, but right also across the life course and lets this, you know, ground their healthy development. I think when I was thinking about the examples that you're giving too, I remember when my own children were young and they would do these small tasks, you can sort of see them light up in a way by being starting to self-identify as a helper, as a person who does important things in this context. And I think that that internal sense of self and that positive self-esteem, it's never too late, obviously. We love to build those things in our adolescence and in our workforce and in all of us. But I think there's just such a potential positive outsized effect across the life course when we start to do these things early, such a strong foundation. And I don't know if you agree with this too. I think that children who feel that way are also, you know, have greater confidence, right? They will take risks. They'll try new things. They have this healthy sense of self that they can have this stable foundation from which to maybe take that little bit of a risk and then come back to because it's there.
That's exactly right. I have definitely found that in my research, that the idea that a child matters unconditionally away from their behavior or their accomplishments or things they do well or they don't do well, that that sense of feeling valued is unconditional. It does not rest on our accomplishments. It does not rest on our behaviors. We are loved. We matter no matter what. So that as much as we can get that message in as early as possible, our kids are growing up in a society, in a world that loves to send them messages that in a hyper-materialistic world like we're living in now, that certain people matter more. The people with the fancy job, with the fancy degree, with the big house, with the this, with the that. And I think our role as caregivers and parents is to give the gift of that unconditional value and worth to our young people, to our babies, to our children, to our emerging adolescents, to our emerging adults, that you matter no matter what, to give them that kind of protective shield against the messages that they will hear in our hyper-achieving, hyper-materialistic culture today.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that resonated so deeply with me about your first book is how protective mattering can be against some of the things that as a pediatrician, as someone who's working in child development and sees all the time, which is, you know, more stress, more worries, more depression among our young people that actually cross socioeconomic boundaries, that crosses a lot of other, you know, different spaces. And so it's mattering is really protective against things that we're all working to care about. You know, all of our work is around wanting our children to thrive. We want them to have healthy mental and physical development. And so I love this idea of mattering as this protective shield. When I have just tried to describe mattering to people, you know, I say, I have this new thing I'm really excited about, new to me, not new to you and to a lot of other people in the field. But I think it feels familiar for a lot of people because it touches on a lot of these ideas and constructs in early childhood that we've been talking about for a long time as being really essential to kids' development. And so when I talk about mattering to colleagues, it seems to ring a bell in a way. And a lot of times it's around belonging. I say, oh, yeah, it is. It's so important for children to feel like they belong. But what I've learned from you and what I'd love you to talk about a little bit is how you see mattering as actually something unique and different than belonging.
So Isaac Pilitensky, who is a researcher on mattering, describes mattering as a meta need or an umbrella term that captures other essential needs like belonging and connection and purpose and self-determination and mastery. But what is so unique about mattering is that it takes these needs and it brings them deeper. So, for example, you can belong to a family, to a neighborhood, to a classroom, but not feel like you matter there. So you can, in the same way, you can feel a deep sense of purpose. I think a lot of people listening to this podcast today are likely working in very purposeful jobs. But what I found in my research for my book on mattering is that purpose is not enough. We need to know that our work makes a difference. We need to know we matter in that way. So even as a doctor or a first responder or a caregiver, right, we have these very purposeful jobs. But if we are disconnected from our impact, we can burn out. So purposeful jobs make us feel valued, but without knowing exactly how we are adding value, being disconnected from that impact over time can burn us out. I actually saw this in my research for my book on mattering. I visited and spent time in a fire station with firefighters in North Charleston, South Carolina. These people do obviously very purposeful jobs. They are saving people. I don't know if you know this because I didn't at the time, but firefighters are often the first to respond to a car wreck or a medical accident or obviously a fire. And then the firefighters are there performing CPR. They're rescuing people out of burning cars. And then EMS shows up. And they take over and they take that patient to the hospital. And firefighters never know what happens next. They never know if their actions did anything. Did that person they extracted from the car ever walk again? And so they were burning out. And so what the fire chief did in that station is he created a system that would track the outcomes of rescues because he wanted his firefighters to know when their actions had saved a life or eased someone's suffering. He wanted them to know they mattered. So I tell this story because I think so many people working in fields of child development, of caring for young people, we feel our work is so purposeful, but we don't always get to reap the benefits of that. We're not often told either because the world just is operating at too fast a pace for people to circle back to us, but we need to know that our work makes a difference. So this is a long way of saying mattering takes us deeper than belonging. Mattering takes us deeper than purpose. One other thing I'll add about belonging is Oprah Winfrey talks a lot about mattering and not the science of mattering, but the feeling of mattering. And she described her third grade teacher, I think it was Mrs. Duncan, as being the first person in her life who made her feel like she mattered. And that was one because she made her feel seen for who she was, which was a strong academic young girl, but also because she gave her a job in the classroom. I believe it was watering the plants. And so Oprah felt valued, but she also saw how she added value to that classroom by keeping those plants alive. So in the same way, we need to do that with our young people. We need to send them the message that they are valued, that they are known, that they are unique and significant. But we also need to give them a chance to add value so that they can get that social proof that we all crave, that our lives have meaning, that we are contributing in positive ways to the world around us.
And how much do you feel like that need to see what you do makes a difference comes at sort of that like individual and interpersonal level versus people like so many of us, I think, in this space, I'm thinking about like the advocates, for example, who might be listening in, go out every day and it's like this tireless, you know, advancing of children who can't speak for themselves and really trying to put positive pressure on a system to do more. And it can be really hard to measure and see the outcomes of that. And so in that space where it's very sort of nebulous, like you hope when you go out and you send this message of why young children matter and why we need to pay attention to supporting the needs of young children and caregivers, and you can't see that always. How do you build mattering in that space, and how do we take care of those who are working, you know, in that really difficult in between like, you know, that it's hard. I feel very reinvigorated sometimes when I go to clinic and I can see, you know, that what I do makes a difference on that individual level. It's harder, I think, when you start to push on these bigger things. Do you have any advice or insight there?
I really do. So in my book on mattering, I interview people like who you just described, advocates who do this work, and it can sometimes feel like it goes out into a void. And so one woman I interviewed, what she is doing is she has created a kind of impact file, is what I call it in the book. She has a Google document where she tracks things. So she works a lot in advocacy in DC. When the work that she's doing has a little bit of traction, when there's a news article that comes out around, you know, the work that she's working on, she puts it in that impact file. When she gets positive email responses, she puts it in that impact file. When she's even created a little bit of like a trophy wall for herself, anything that, you know, anything that she does where people really point out how she matters, she frames it, she puts it in her space so that she's constantly connected to her impact. I will also say that this is the role of colleagues and friends.
I was just thinking that, yeah.
Close the loop, right? We're to close the loop. Let's say, I'll just give a little example. Let's say you say to a colleague, you know, I would love your advice on, you know, some crisis or challenge I'm having at work. They give you your advice. You take some of their advice. A couple of days later, send that email, send that text. Your advice was so meaningful to me. I acted on it, and here's what happened. Close the loop. Since I've learned about mattering, I make such a point in my day as often as I can to close the loop on people. It might be the teacher for my children who invested in their writing and gave really meaningful feedback on a paper, and to just send a quick little note to say, I just want you to know that the time you spent helping my young child with his writing, I am seeing him really bloom, and I am so grateful for that extra time that you have spent with him. So just these little moments. Mattering happens in these micro moments, and feelings of anti-mattering happen in micro moments too. Anti-mattering is a construct, an idea that was developed by a researcher in Canada named Gordon Flett. Anti-mattering is not a low level of mattering. It is messages in our environment that we do not matter. It is being ignored. It's being talked over. It's contributing in our workplaces or in our communities, but no one ever acknowledging our contributions. That is the work of anti-mattering. And I will tell you that in our culture today, we send, unfortunately, a lot of messages of anti-mattering to people. That to me is a root of so many of the mental health struggles that we are seeing in young people and old. Mattering matters throughout the lifespan. As we mentioned, from the first days until we take our last breath, we need to know we matter.
No, that resonates so deeply. And I think like what you were saying about both mattering and anti-mattering is like making people matter, feel like they matter. It's being explicit and specific, right? Is that fair? Like,
that's absolutely right. Well,
yeah, because it really makes that connection between what they did and how it added value, that adding value part, right?
Absolutely. I was keynoting at an educational conference, a big conference, and a teacher was given an award. And he was very excited to receive it. He received it by his colleagues, but it was the second part of the award that actually made him light up. So they gave him the physical award, but they also gave him a gigantic jar of M&Ms. And they said, this is his favorite 3:30 snack. And so we want him to have these M&Ms so that he can always have his favorite 3:30 snack. It was feeling seen and known as the individual that you are. So it's not just the award, which was nice. You know, you are a valued teacher and you won this award, but it was that feeling that he was known. Mattering is in the details. Mattering is in the details. So remembering those details, coming back to them, letting people, I mean, I'll tell you just another little example. I was visiting my son in college and he invited two of his friends out to dinner and he asked for more mustard. He was eating a burger and he asked for more mustard. And one of his college friends said to him, "Boy, William always doubles up on the mustard. He loves his mustard." And I saw my son light up. It's these little moments. Someone notices me. Someone sees me as unique, even in our quirks, right? Even in our little quirks, that we are seen and loved and valued for who we are deep inside.
That makes me think of what you, I've heard you talk about when it comes to like the value of deeply knowing a child, like mustard, but also, how did you put it? Like get a PhD in your child. Like, what is that? What do you think? Can you describe what that would look like in very young children and how we might sort of build that into everyday mattering moments?
Yes, I think from our earliest ages, and I didn't know this as a new parent, but as I had two and then three children, I was able to see from the earliest days some elements of their personality, their determination, their humor, their charming way of connecting, their introversion or their extroversion or their introversion, that they can maybe get overwhelmed by too much sound. And so it's the way I describe it, as you said, is getting a PhD in each of our children or the children in our care doesn't necessarily mean doing 10 years of deep research, but simply noticing. I mean, a friend of mine did something very clever with her children when they were really young, before, just as they were learning how to crawl. She would put out a few different toys to see which one they would gravitate towards. So it's really just kind of taking a little bit of a back seat and observing and watching and noticing. And so that's how she got to know her kids, is by giving different opportunities and watching what would light her child up.
I love that. And it's so true, because you can have three children from the same background with very different ways that they might, internalize that feeling of mattering. So at this center, we're spending a lot of time focusing on how places affect development. And we're realizing, increasingly kids don't have these relationships with their caregivers in isolation. They're really influenced by their whole developmental environment and the places where they live. And, we're talking a lot about how, in the United States, historic, but also current public policies really have led to these deep inequalities across the places where kids are growing up. So can you talk a little bit about how place affects our sense of mattering? And really, what can we do to make sure that children and their caregivers actually also feel that they matter regardless of their zip code?
So I would love to take it in two parts. So you mentioned how important the ecosystem of our children's mattering involves both the adults in their lives and also the places, the physical places where they are. So first, with the adults in their lives, decades of resilience research find that young people, our children's resilience, rests fundamentally on the resilience of the adults in their lives. And adult resilience rests fundamentally on the depth and support of our relationships. So as a caregiver, it feels a little bit counterintuitive to put your mental health, your well-being, your support system front and center. Because in order for you to be the sturdy adult that you want to be for your child, what I've come to learn is that sturdy adults need sturdy adults too in their lives, who can hold them up when they are struggling, so that they could be those first responders day in and day out to their young people's struggles. So I would say to caregivers, to prioritize your own mattering, to prioritize your support system, to prioritize your own well-being and mental health, not just for yourself, but for the people in your care. There was actually a really interesting study that was conducted at the Mayo Clinic. It was a pilot study that was looking at busy physician mothers. And what the researchers were looking at was, could a simple intervention strengthen the resilience of those women, those physicians? And what they found, they did a 12-week study where they had women meet in small groups, five or six people, for an hour a week to share their struggles and to support one another. What the researchers found was after 12 weeks, the cortisol levels in the women had dropped. Their sense of well-being had increased. These women even reported like feeling better parents. And that is because our sense of mattering ripples out into our kids. When we feel sturdy, when we feel supported, when we have bandwidth, we can show up and be those sturdy supports for our kids. So I just want to underscore to caregivers, it is not selfish to prioritize your needs. It is not selfish to prioritize your sense of mattering. You need to do it, not just for yourself, but for your young people. Now, on the other element of mattering, mattering in the spaces that we inhabit, it profoundly shapes how we feel like we matter. When communities are well-resourced, when they feel safe, when they feel cohesive and interdependent, they send a message to young people. Even they send a message also to the caregivers and the adults in those young people's lives that you are worth investing in, that you matter here. But when neighborhoods lack green spaces or quality childcare or reliable transportation, they can send the opposite message that your needs and by extension, you don't matter. That those are the messages of anti-mattering. We see them in some of the architecture that's been put up in cities that prohibit people from sleeping, the homeless people. That's anti-mattering. That is, you are a human, but your needs don't matter here. You don't matter enough to give you a bench so that you can sleep and have your needs met. That is anti-mattering. And those same anti-mattering messages are sent when young people have to grow up and commute to school in neighborhoods, even during the daytime, are unsafe. When there isn't enough food on the table, when their classrooms are stuffed and their teachers are overtaxed, that is a message sent, your needs don't matter enough to give you the kind of resources you really need to thrive. So the good news is that we can intentionally build ecosystems of mattering. That's what it looks like when we have programs that make neighborhoods feel safe and walkable and socially connected, whether it's building, you know, bright, colorful, engaging playgrounds or community gardens or local childcare hubs. When the systems around our families affirm their worth, these adults are able to pass on that sense of mattering to their children.
I was thinking about the first category that you talked about. I can relate to the physician mother part of, you know, an hour a week. And I can imagine that these same policies and systems can make that ability to carve out an hour a week, to have, say, oh, I can set aside all these other demands for an hour. Those policies can make that a lot easier to do or a lot more challenging. And so it was making me think about paid family leave and support for paid childcare that's accessible and high quality. Like, what can we do to make it easier for adults to take care of their own mattering? Besides telling them, here's one more thing, which, you know, is not what you were saying, but what the policy, I think, environment can create. Here's one more thing that you need to do, make time for this, versus what do we do to lighten the load, to alleviate the burden, to, you know, overload this, you know, truck that's sort of built up with all these demands so that you can show up in these spaces and take care of yourself. So,
oh, that's exactly right. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind when you say that are the ability of corporations and companies and businesses mm-hmm. to, I mean, there is a moral responsibility that our workplaces have. They researchers call it the long arm of the job, that when we either feel like we matter at work or we don't feel like we matter at work. So let's say we don't feel like we matter at work. Let's say we are working 8, 10, 12-hour shifts where we don't feel like we have a voice, where we don't have control over our schedules, where we are put down, made to feel invisible, made to feel like cogs in a machine, made to feel like we do not matter, that we are not valued, when we don't know how we are adding value. How can we show up to our kids at the end of the day, at the end of a work day, having gone through all those hours of feeling like we don't matter? How can we show up and be the sturdy supports to our kids? We can't. Researchers call it proximal separation. When we, as tired, exhausted, stressed out parents, can show up at the end of the day wanting to be there for our kids, but the stress and the incivility and the rudeness we experienced is hijacking our brains so that we are not able to fully be there for our kids. So proximal separation is this idea that we are in the same room as our young people, as the children in our care, but we are disconnected from them because we are so consumed by the messages of anti-mattering. Anti-mattering hijacks our cognitive resources in a way that drains them. So companies can play such a critical role. And it doesn't mean changing huge policies. While I do believe that actually there should be some policies here for American families, we should have, you know, paid leave, we should have flexible scheduling, we should be able to have predictable hours. I mean, these are just baseline things that every caregiver needs. But there are also little things in the day that can send messages of mattering. I actually saw this in a factory I visited in Phillips, Wisconsin, where factory workers were assembling parts of a big machine. And what the company did there to help them connect to their impact is they gave them story cards at each station that showed them how the piece they were assembling fit into the final product, where that final product was going, and who was going to use it. So their job was not just to be a cog in a machine. They had this feeling that their work was purposeful, that it was meaningful, that what they were doing was meaningful. And I talked to these workers and they had tears in their eyes that they were made to feel so much like they mattered. I'll give you another little example about how companies can make people feel like they matter or they don't. These factory workers the parts that they needed to assemble were very expensive. And so they were put in cages that were locked and they needed a manager to open up the cage for them to access the part they needed. And they said how it made them feel so distrusted. And the owner of the factory said, you know what? That's not fair. I trust you. He opened it. He sent the signal to those people. You are valuable. I trust you. And I will tell you, the turnover in that factory is almost zero. It is almost zero. People work in those jobs for decades, jobs that people might feel are thankless jobs. Those people feel appreciated and known, and they talk about how it has transformed their relationships with their spouses, with their significant others, and with their children. So there are little things companies can do to unlock a sense of mattering. And also, though, I don't want to take them off the hook, we also need big policy changes. When it comes to philanthropists, you know, one of the things that they can do, and many are doing this, so I'm sort of stating the obvious here, is not coming into a community and assuming what the needs are, but rather taking community members and asking them, what are the genuine needs here? What do you need? What are the actual needs? And partner with them to meet it. So those are just a few ways that we can really build up a sense of mattering for caregivers, for people working with children, so that they can have that energy and that to show up fully, but also that they can model what it is to feel like you matter in the world.
The example you gave a few minutes back now about a message of anti-mattering when you tell someone with an architectural change, you know, you're not worthy of a place to sleep. It's stuck in my head a little bit. And do you have any insights or your own opinions on that space, just because I'm very interested thinking about children who are unhoused or children who are homeless, families that are living in these sort of really challenging circumstances. Are there ways at a policy level and a design level, obviously starting with listening, as you mentioned, but that mattering shows up in those spaces?
Well, there are. So I am very privileged to be on the board of the Coalition for the Homeless here in New York. And I will tell you that New York City is the only city in the country that has a right to shelter. So I would start by saying, and I know that this is huge and hard, but it is a human right to have shelter. It is a human right to be fed, and it is a human right to feel like you matter. And so I would start with housing and making the assumption that every human has the right to shelter, particularly in a country as rich as ours. It's almost unfathomable to me to walk around New York City and see tens of thousands of people homeless in one of the richest cities in the world. So I would say shelter. I would say affordable housing. That the reason people are homeless is because of one issue, that there is not enough affordable housing. So those are two things that I think are the most critical. More housing, more shelters for interim moments. And when you are working with a client who is experiencing homelessness, and the Coalition for the Homeless is wonderful at doing this, is letting them feel unique. You know, not another statistic, not another person. This is a person who maybe weeks ago had an apartment, experienced a health crisis, lost their job, and are now homeless. They are a unique individual having this experience. So really being top of mind, even with all of the case work we have, to not allow ourselves to feel crushed enough that we don't see the individual sitting inside in front of us.
Jenny, every time I talk to you, I just feel so like I want to go out and help and build mattering. And you're just very compelling when you describe these things. And we're just so lucky to have you now helping us make these connections to early childhood. And thank you for all the time and all the inspiration and for being here.
Well, I'm so grateful to you and all your important work. So thank you for including me in it.
Let's talk again soon.
I'd love it.
Thank you for listening to The Brain Architects. To learn more about the importance of mattering in early childhood and how to support a sense of mattering in young children, head to our website, developingchild.harvard.edu, to read the new working paper. It includes research on how mattering affects children's mental and physical health across their lifespan, as well as concrete tips that we can all take to build an ecosystem of mattering for children and the adults who care for them. And be sure to check out the center's website and social channels to find a range of science on early childhood development topics, from the importance of responsive relationships to toxic stress to how climate change is affecting children and their caregivers' health and well-being. See you next time.